It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So now on to revisit the simmering controversy over the search, which ended earlier this month with the selection of former IBM executive Bruce Harreld to be the new president of the University of Iowa. The Faculty Senate, undergraduate and graduate student groups have all voted no confidence in the Board of Regents. Harreld was unanimously chosen by the nine Regents members. Faculty, staff, and students have all expressed concern about Harreld's qualifications to be the next president of the University of Iowa. But many questions also remain about the process used to select him for that position, including how someone almost completely unknown to recruiting firms and academic circles ended up in the search to lead a major research university. Joining me now, Christina Bohannon, University of Iowa law professor, president of the Faculty Senate, and a member of the University of Iowa President Search Committee. Christina Bohannon, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, summarize quickly. What are your main points of criticism about the search and selection?
The main point of criticism for me personally for the Faculty Senate really had to do with the fact that the Regents solicited our feedback. They were really encouraging of us to participate in the process, to make our thoughts known, and they said that they would value that feedback. And there was virtually no support for Bruce Harreld's candidacy among faculty, staff, or students at the university. And so when he was chosen, the thought was that they had not valued or respected that feedback in the process. And that really should be a concern to a lot of people, because it's really the faculty, staff, and students who are involved in the teaching and learning process every single day. And we know the university very well, and we know higher education very well. And so, you know, it should be of concern to people who care about the quality of the academic programs and, you know, or anyone really who cares just about the status and ranking of the institution as a whole.
Mm-hmm. What about the question of, do we know who threw Bruce Harreld's hat into the ring, how he entered this, how he became a finalist? As I mentioned, they're an unknown in academic circles.
Right. So I don't know exactly how Bruce Harreld became a candidate. I mentioned early this week, Dean Sarah Gardiel and I, both of whom were on the search committee, said that we had met with Bruce Harreld in July when he came to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics to give a talk. And the search committee chair, Jean Robillard, who is the VP for medical affairs, invited us over and said, there's someone we want to, you know, have you here and meet. And so, you know, we assumed this was maybe a potential candidate because it's the search committee chair who was asking us to come over. So we went over and we met with Mr. Harreld. And I'll tell you, at that time, we talked about a number of things. We talked about some of the themes that Bruce Harreld mentioned in his town hall and other interviews about how, you know, organizations, even very good ones, can succeed further by changing their culture and being adaptive to new challenges and changing their culture over time. And we also talked about, you know, other issues confronting the university. But at that point in time, it was very unclear whether he had any interest in this position. We didn't even talk about his interest specifically.
Nothing untoward per se about that visit before he was selected as a candidate?
Absolutely not. I mean, look, we were a search committee. Search committees have to find people. That's what we do. And we were told to, by the search firm, by the committee, go out, find people, recruit people, vet people. You know, that's what we do. Now, search committees also do interview people once they are in the pool, and that's another function that the search committee serves. But the piece earlier, we were told by the search firm that in some ways that's our most important function, because we have to find people out there and we have to, you know, talk to them. We have to see whether this might even be someone we would want to include in the pool. And so that was it's a non-issue. This is just something that search committees do.
Mm-hmm. A retired professor, Harreld Hammond, an emeritus professor in the College of Dentistry, has filed a lawsuit to add a further dimension to this, a lawsuit arguing that the University of Iowa Presidential Search Committee repeatedly violated open meetings laws, open meetings law, and that its actions should be voided. Do you think that this lawsuit holds its weight?
Well, I am a party to that lawsuit, unfortunately, as a member of the search committee, so I can't say very much about it. But I will just say that based on everything that we did in that committee, I find it very hard to see what these allegations are about. But I'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where do we go from here, Christina Bohannon? The faculty is upset. There are conspiracy theories. There's now this lawsuit. Experts are saying that Harold and effectively the University of Iowa will not be successful without faculty and community support. Do you see this controversy fading and that support coming at some point? What's the next chapter?
Well, far be it from me to predict what faculty will do. I think that's really hard to know. But I will say that, in a large organization like this, there are always going to be people who have doubts or suspicions about processes like this. And that's somewhat understandable. But, what I'm hearing a lot of from a lot of different people, and not speaking for the Senate here, but what I've heard from a lot of different people is, people really want to think about what's in the best interest of the institution and how to move the institution forward. And this university is so important to us. And we are thinking about how do we solve the problem of crushing student debt? How do we eradicate sexual assault on campus? How do we move our research forward and make and maintain its excellence in the face of, decreasing federal aid? I mean, there are all kinds of issues that we really need to be dealing with. And the thing that I'm hearing from a lot of faculty is really wanting to focus on those issues and move forward.
Mm-hmm. With a president, Bruce Harreld, moving forward?
Well, if he is going to be here on November 2nd, then we'll have to see how that goes. But, I think that we're moving slowly. And I think a lot of people are starting to try to think about how to separate what has happened up till this point and the process by which we got here from the question of how we move forward and what our relationship will be with Bruce Harreld. And he has said that he cares a lot about shared governance. He is reaching out to a number of faculty to meet with them. And so we will see how all of that goes.
Of course, a lot of people listening to this conversation have nothing whatever to do with university politics. So enlighten us about Bruce Harreld was brought in. I think some of the words that the board president, Rastetter, said were innovation and change to bring in this different sort of president. So what do people against him, opposed to him as president, think are the real reasons behind the selection of Bruce Harreld? Is there a hidden agenda that's not been spoken?
I don't know. I can't speak for the Regents on this. But I think that the notion that faculty and staff and students all opposed Bruce Harreld on the ground that we're resistant to change or that we're not embracing that innovation that they've talked about is just not consistent with what I know about the people on our campus. We are all about innovation. We are all about moving forward. We're all about excellence in teaching and research and community. And so, that part just isn't accurate. But I will say that I think there are just differences of opinion here about who is best to lead us, toward that kind of change and toward that kind of innovation. And one of the main concerns has really been with the lack of experience in administration and higher education. And that's a really big issue. I think that's a legitimate concern that people have. On the other hand, Bruce Harreld has acknowledged that he lacks that experience and that he is going to try to work with people and reach out and hope to be educated, about those things. So, again, we'll see. It's going to be – there's no question that it's going to be a process. I think different faculty will have different views on how to move forward from here, but a lot of us are thinking about moving forward.
Okay, very good. Undoubtedly, more chapters even before the new president, the president-elect Bruce Harreld, takes his position as the new president of the University of Iowa. Christina Bohannon, University of Iowa law professor, president of the Faculty Senate, and member of the University of Iowa President Search Committee. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Does borrowing money to buy a new home, say, or to finance a college education have an ethical or moral dimension? What about declaring bankruptcy? Iowa State University will hold the Ethics of Debt Symposium next week, September 24th through the 26th. It's organized by Kate Paget Walsh, an assistant professor of philosophy at ISU, also Bill Carter, an ISU assistant professor of world languages and cultures. They join me now. Hi, Kate. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hello.
So, there's more to it than can I repay this loan? What is there?
Well, I think there's two things. One thing that we can all observe, I think, is the degree to which we're saturated with debt right now. All of us, you know, experience debt in one form or other, and the debt levels are quite high. They've gone down a little bit since the financial crisis and the recession, but still our debt levels are quite high as a percentage of our household income. And then the other thing is the complexity of debt has really gone up quite a bit in the last 20 years or so. And so we're experiencing new forms of debt, new quandaries concerning debt, new ethical questions, essentially.
Mm-hmm. For instance, an ethical question. Throw out there a couple.
Well, one of the kinds of concerns, one of the things that comes out of the financial crisis is thinking about the new ways in which lenders don't hold on to debt anymore. That our loans that they issue to us are securitized and bundled into these securities that investors look at and analysts rate. And what then happens when that system encounters serious problems, when there's a failure, which is what we observed with the financial crisis? What does that mean then for borrowers when their mortgage is underwater, they're trying to figure out how to pay those bills? What does that mean for the ethics of default, ethics of repayment, mm-hmm, those kinds mm-hmm. of questions?
When we consider the ethics of debt, whose responsibility is it? Is it the financial institutions, the lenders, or is the burden solely on the borrower? Borrower beware.
Yeah, I mean, there are these questions about what does it mean to be a responsible borrower today? Mm-hmm. As a student, as someone who's not at a university who's looking to borrow from a mortgage or mm-hmm. use credit cards. So what does it mean to be a responsible borrower when the complexity of debt is so great and we have so many options that we didn't have previously?
Mm-hmm. Let's take an example of one I've run into when we talk about student debt, for example. I've had people call into this very show. A mother of a university student who graduated with a degree, $100,000 in debt for, I think it was a liberal arts degree, a communications degree. Now, do you consider questions like that? How can you possibly repay a $100,000 debt with a degree that probably won't end in a career that will pay off?
Well, I'm glad you brought up student debt because our event kicks off with a student debt forum on Thursday night, and we'll be screening a short film and then discussing these types of issues, with students in mind. With regard to liberal arts degrees, I think they're certainly valuable, but perhaps not in the same type of category as say an engineering degree, mm-hmm. but it's interesting because I think that our symposium is really going to highlight how the liberal arts and the humanities are really well situated to help us understand the complexities of debt. So
mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, a concrete example. We talk about predatory loans. What makes a loan predatory if the borrower has agreed to the terms?
This is a great question, and there's been quite a bit of quite a few developments when we think about predatory lending recently, just this summer. So there have been new rules issued to the Military Lending Act, I believe it's called, to try and put further restrictions on what kind of loans can be issued to military service members because they take out a disproportionately high number of payday loans and similar loans. And now the question is for the rest of us who are not in the military, what sorts of protection should there be? There's the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been doing a lot of good work to try and understand the situations borrowers face and the business practices of these lenders. They've been floating a series of proposals that would, if enacted, serve to create things like cool-off periods so that people couldn't take out a loan, and then when they can't repay it, then have to roll it over into another loan and continue in a string of many of these loans, essentially going deeper and deeper into debt and mm-hmm. unable to repay them. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of these are great developments. So to your question of what makes something a predatory loan, that's an open question, I think, that we need to debate. But when we look at the way that some forms of lending impact, especially those who are in poverty or those who are striving to make ends meet, we can see business models that seem to prey upon difficulties people are having and don't serve their population well.
Mm-hmm. At the same time your symposium is going on, we have a presidential candidate who has used bankruptcy many times in his very successful career as a real estate mogul. When is it ethical to declare bankruptcy or default on a loan? Is that something you will also discuss at the symposium?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know if that specific question will come up. I imagine it might. Our symposium is going to have cover a wide array of topics, and we have scholars coming in from as far away as Germany and Ghana, and certainly bankruptcy is one of our sessions that we'll be covering.
Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is going back to the complexity that I mentioned earlier. That the repayment options that people have are so complex right now. And so there's been some discussion recently of ways we could streamline those. The IRS already has quite a bit of information about our income and so forth and getting help with repayment. So that's one aspect of it. But also when we think about default, one thing that's very important, and this is going to come up in the documentary we show on Thursday night as part of the forum that's open to the public, is the role that for-profit colleges play in driving up student debt levels. And we saw, recently with the closing of Corinthian College, and now that we have the question of fraud. Some campuses of Corinthian were actually engaged in fraud. So at what point do students, have they been fraudulently treated, essentially, and they have a case for not repaying their debts?
Mm-hmm. And finally, I wanted to ask you, what about when we go from individuals to countries, the debts of countries? I looked at the running U.S. national debt, looked that up on the internet today, something like $18 trillion. What happens to the ethics and morals, the implications there when it's a country?
Well, I think a number of our speakers will be addressing this. We have sessions that will deal with debt in the state, and we have other panelists who will be discussing kind of case studies, for instance, in Quito, Ecuador, and also in post-Soviet Kyrgyzstan.
And I think this is a really important issue, state debt, both at home. Certainly, we're going to be approaching another debt ceiling coming this fall. So it's important at home, but also internationally. When we think about some of the things that have been talked about recently with the Pope, he's been highlighting, poverty around the world. And how debt plays into poverty, both at home and abroad. What's the relationship? I think these are really important questions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Bill Carter and Kate Paget Walsh on the faculty at Iowa State University, organizers of the Ethics of Debt Symposium to be held next week, September 24th through the 26th. Kate and Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, he has done it again. The young running prodigy from Cedar Falls has broken another world record. After setting a world age group record last year in a 5K run at the age of 6, Jaden Merrick, he's now 7, is the world age group record holder in the half marathon. Jaden finished Saturday's park-to-park half marathon in 1 hour, 43 minutes, and 34 seconds. That beat the old record by, I think, about 20 seconds. Joining me now is Brent Merrick of Cedar Falls. He is the father of 7-year-old Jaden, the world record holder. Brent, congratulations.
Thank you. But I always tell people that I shouldn't be the one getting congratulated because he did it all on his own. And we just wanted to say first that it's not 100% record quite yet. All things point to it will be. He did run faster than the current record. It was on a certified course, and he met all the criteria. So basically, we're just waiting on the paperwork processing, which hopefully is done by the end of this week or the first part of next week, and then it will be an official world record for him.
All right. Well, I think we'll talk with Jaden in just a moment, but first of all, let me talk with you. Is there a tradition of runners in your family?
Well, I run, but I'm nowhere near as fast as he is, so... Yes, I think he picked up the running from me and his mom because he would see us go out for runs. And then that's when he wanted to start. And he started and then wanted to do his first 5K when he was five. And it's just taken off from there.
Mm-hmm. And if my calculations are right, this Saturday's half marathon with the time that he has gave him splits of less than 8 minutes per mile?
Yes, he averaged 7:55 miles.
7:55 per mile at the age of seven. That's over the course of more than 13 miles. That is amazing. I didn't know such little legs could do that.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's too many sets little legs around that can, but somehow his can.
Uh-huh. And what did you do to prepare him, or did he do this all his own?
No, he had a training plan. He has a coach that works with him. We basically heart rate train him so we can keep an eye on him, make sure he's not overtraining, make sure he's not getting sick, make sure the training load is not too much for him. He went from a level this spring and summer of about 10 to 12 miles a week, and his highest week was about 34, 36 mile a week with mixed training in there, easy runs, some speed work, and then Saturdays were reserved for long runs.
Okay.
So that's how his training went.
Hey, Brent, I wonder if we can talk with your son, your record-holding son, Jaden. Is he there for a moment?
Yes, he is. I'll let you talk to him right now. Here he is.
Hi.
Jaden Merrick, congratulations.
Thanks.
How does it feel to be the world age group record holder in the half marathon?
Good.
Did you know that you would get the record? Were you going for the record at the half marathon for the world record?
Yes.
How hard was it? Were you really pushing yourself to the limit?
Yeah.
What were you thinking about the whole time? Because this took you, well, close to 2 hours, didn't it?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the finish line.
The finish line. And then you finally arrived, and what happened there?
When I got the record, I was surprised.
So what's next for you, Jaden? You want to continue to run?
Yeah.
Do you have another goal already in mind?
Yeah, I want to make it to the Junior Olympics.
Do you think someday you'll be in the real Olympics? Is that your goal?
Yeah.
Okay, Jaden, we wish you the best. You've made us proud here in Iowa to be the World Age Group record holder for the half marathon. Take care.
Yeah, I will.
Coming up in just a moment, we listen back to some notable conversations from earlier this year, including the search for Jack Trice's lost jersey, research on distracted driving, and the story of how one more name was added to the Iowa Vietnam War Monument. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Fridays is a day we like to have our news buzz conversations, shorter conversations about news during the week that we didn't get to otherwise. And this edition of News Buzz, we're listening back to some of the favorite conversations I've had with various people over the past few months. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jack Trice is a revered name in Iowa history. Trice became the first African-American athlete at Iowa State University in Ames, participating in both track and football. The plaque on Iowa State University's Jack Trice Stadium reads, "In memory of Jack Trice, who died October 8, 1923, of injuries received in the Ames, Minnesota football game." Josh and Lori Kugavi have been on a long hunt for Jack Trice's football jersey. They join us now. Hello, Josh and Lori.
Hi.
Hello.
And I understand Josh has a severe hearing impairment, and Lori, you'll be helping out with a little bit of translation as we have this conversation.
That's correct.
Before we get into the hunt for the jersey, remind us how Jack Trice died in 1923 and why we honor him today.
It was in the Minnesota game.
It was his first major game.
Which was his first major game.
As he died in Derby.
And he died as a result of the injuries
that
he suffered in the third quarter of that game. When he was trying to make a tackle. He got trampled by three Minnesota players.
And he died the following Monday.
And people who were at the game mentioned that they didn't believe that there was any foul play. And that's what happened to him.
So you've been on a hunt for his jersey. What first started this hunt for Jack Trice's jersey?
Well, last year when we were marketing our Iowa State blanket, we made a trip to Iowa. And in that trip, we met a whole bunch of people who started to talk about this, that there might be this jersey in Wisconsin. And actually, it seemed like it was quite a good rumor that was going around. And when we got back to California, we were able to connect the dots a little bit. And then we just ended up doing a little more research, and we found this man that actually did have Ira's jersey.
It was a jersey. Okay, this is not Jack Trice's jersey. This is the jersey of the team captain, a man by the name of Ira Young.
Yep, Ira Young.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And during that football game, the one in which, after which, Jack Trice died in Minneapolis, Jack Trice was injured, and Ira Young was one of the people who actually carried Jack Trice off the field?
Yes, that's correct. He was one of the men that carried him off the field. Yeah.
And what does the jersey look like today?
Well, the colors are actually still very vivid. The gold is a very vivid gold. The friction strips are actually a grayish color, and there is a bright cardinal red number, number one, on the back of it. And because it's almost 100 years old, obviously there's a lot of peeling and holes due to moths and whatnot, but it's still in pretty top condition, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. And this particular jersey of the team captain, Ira Young, has some indication of the injury of Jack Trice on it, some blood?
When we really look at it, there are these kind of rusty, dark stains on the jersey. And we wouldn't be surprised if one of them is blood. We would definitely would have to research a little bit more if it is the blood of Jack Trice. But right now, unfortunately, we probably couldn't even go that far because we'd have to find a member of Jack Trice's family and whatnot. But metaphorically, we could say that Jack Trice did touch it, and Ira Young helped him off the field, and it's still a strong connection to Jack Trice.
What is a jersey from this era of this particular type worth?
You would have to ask yourself, what is such an iconic piece of Iowa State history worth?
And a piece of the Babe Ruth of Iowa State.
And Jack Trice is, to us, the Babe Ruth of Iowa State. And in 2 years of extensive research, this has been the best thing we have found to date.
We're so happy because we have it with the Iowa State community.
And ultimately, we are so thrilled and happy to share this with the Iowa State community.
Well, yes, priceless. Now, what will happen to the jersey? What are your plans with it?
Right now, we don't have a definitive answer for that, but we do have plans, and when we do have a definitive answer, it will be up on our website, and we will announce it. We will make it public with what is going to happen with the jersey.
Okay, and your website is kagavi.com, kagavi.com. We'll post that on iowapublicradio.org. Thank you for talking with us. It's a fascinating story. Josh and Lori Kagavi, they found a jersey from 1923, not belonging to Jack Trice, but to the team captain, Ira Young, a jersey from a Cyclone history from 1923. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Do you have a teen driver in your family at present? Or are you likely to have a teen driver in your midst in the near future? Well, if so, listen up to this conversation from earlier this year. It was after the release of a new study by vehicle safety researchers at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, and the study showed that passengers are the most frequent distraction for teen drivers involved in crashes. And it was a first-of-its-kind study which reviewed video data of nearly 1,700 crashes involving teen drivers between the ages of 16 and 19. And it found that distracted driving contributes to nearly 60% of car crashes involving teen drivers. Joining me for this conversation from April of this year, when the study was released, two faculty from the source of the study, the Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research Division at the University of Iowa Public Policy Center, Dan McGeehee, the director of the center, and Cher Carney, a senior research associate. I began by asking them how they got data from 1,700 crashes.
Yeah, I think this is really where we've had a really long history in looking at what's called naturalistic driving. And 8 years ago, we did the first study of its kind in the U.S. where we put little video cameras, little crash recorder type cameras, in a group of about 35 teenagers at Clear Creek Amana High School. And that was really sort of the basis of this overall crash study. It was the first time that we were able to sort of get a view inside of the vehicle. We use that to sort of enhance young drivers' ability to drive. But one of the byproducts of putting these little recorders in vehicles is that we get crashes.
Mm-hmm. And you get crashes. So it's a split screen. If you'd like to see what these look like, it's not easy watching, I have to tell you. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and you'll see a compilation of some of the crashes. There are no deaths in the ones that we show.
Right. We did not have any fatal crashes in our study.
Okay. So you don't have to be worried about that. But it is harrowing watching nevertheless. Cher Carney, you watched how many of these videos?
We looked at almost 7,000 crashes, but this study was based on a review of almost 1,700.
Mm-hmm. So you have that split screen. You see what's going on. The camera is on the rearview mirror, and there's a camera facing outward where the car is going out to the road, and then there's an interior camera that shows the driver, teen driver, very often listening to the radio, chatting with someone in the car, and very often texting, or just, it's amazing how many things, not just teens, but all of us drivers get up to when we're behind the wheel besides driving, Dan.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about these data, as you mentioned, 60% of the of our crashes had distraction present. In previous data from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that looked at police-reported data, only about 14% of crashes had distraction present. So we really see an overwhelming increase in what's reported from the police versus what we actually see in the real world.
Is that the difference between teen and adult drivers, or we just think that this data is better data for can apply to most all drivers?
Yeah, well, this is among the teen population specifically.
Oh, I see. So it was 15% reported
right.
by the police. So
right.
this is a significantly higher number. Why did you get so much more distraction in your study?
Well, I think part of it is just how police can sort of capture what are self-reported at the scene. Most people don't admit that to being on a phone or having a bunch of distraction in the back seat prior to a crash. So those things are oftentimes not visible to law enforcement when they do their investigation around a crash. Whereas we sort of have the ground truth. We see into the vehicle. We see outside of the vehicle. So we can sort of see what's present there.
Cher Carney, as you reviewed these videos of crashes, what came to the fore? What are the most What type of behavior leads to crashes in terms of distraction?
Well, in 15% of the crashes we reviewed, there was some type of passenger distraction present. That means the driver was either looking at or talking with the person next to them or behind them. 12% of the crashes had cell phone use present, and the large majority of that was texting.
Okay. And you see that in the video that we posted on our Facebook page. What about external factors? Are those leading to crashes? Is that what you looked at as well?
We did see that was one of the top three distractions were people looking outside of the vehicle at some place that we couldn't tell exactly what they were looking at.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more, Dan McGeehee, about because you broke down why crashes happened. Take us through that in a little bit more detail.
So what's unique about this particular system is that we see about 12 seconds before a crash. It sort of operates much like your DVR, your TiVo at home, where the system is always on, but it doesn't record until it actually gets sort of an abrupt event like steering or braking or a crash. So then it can go back in time 12 seconds. And then we take that 12 seconds and sort of go through that frame by frame and look what is present in terms of the different behaviors leading up to the impact. Mm-hmm. So were there passengers there, or their interaction, were they looking away, typing away at their phone, and so forth.
So a lot of these videos, and if you watch that, it's simply you don't have your eyes on the road.
Right.
You're going around the curve, you don't have your eyes on the road. You're driving at night, and you're looking down in your lap at your cell phone.
Yes. It's pretty remarkable to see the kinds of behaviors out there. Across the board. I mean, while this particular study just looked at teens, and I should say this was sponsored by the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety, certainly adults, especially young adults and middle-aged adults are now, the cell phone is ubiquitous in their lives as well. So they're addicted to their cell phones just like teenagers are as well.
Okay, so the takeaway here for concerned parents and any teens listening, the more passengers you have on board, the greater likelihood of a distracted crash?
The more passengers there are, the larger the number of distractions. There's more moving around in the vehicle, more horsing around, and the volume inside the vehicle increases considerably as well.
Mm-hmm. And as far as texting, we know we can be talking on our smartphones, we can be texting, we can be, unfortunately, we've been watching videos. So the more involved you are with your cell phone, the greater the distraction.
Right. I think if you take a look at all of us, especially teens, are Snapchatting and Instagram. There's so much social media. You know, literally every week there is a new social media application to interact with. So it's something that we are constantly doing, and we're constantly interrupted. So if you think about driving, we get interrupted by our cell phones a lot. So it's really that ill-timed glance away from the road that can really be the one that leads to a crash.
Based on the data, 1,700 crashes figured into this first-of-a-kind study. What is the takeaway for Iowa lawmakers here? What would you like to be have the takeaway be?
Well, one of the things is that we've recently, in the last year, changed our graduated driver licensing system in the state to have a passenger limit. However, included in that limit, in that law, was that parents can opt out of the law, which is sort of very unique nationally, that you can choose to opt out of a particular law, which renders it rather ineffective.
And how many do opt out?
Right now, 90%, 93% is the latest number, have opted out of this law. So
that's
you can
hardly a law, is it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So this kind of study really helps us with the data to be able to go back to lawmakers and say, you know, distraction with passengers is really a key issue in crashes. And, you know, over 40 kids a year in the state of Iowa lose their lives in car crashes. It's the number one cause of death for our youngest.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This year marks the 40th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War. It's a war that cost nearly 60,000 American lives. Let's listen back to this conversation I had earlier this year with Vietnam veteran Dan Gannon of Ankeny. Dan is also the Vietnam Veterans of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. I asked Dan to tell us the story of how he helped add the missing name of a fellow Iowan, Douglas Peterson, to the Iowa Vietnam War Monument. Douglas Peterson died of wounds he suffered from fighting in Vietnam, so I began by asking Dan to tell us more about this fallen Iowan.
Well, I guess I don't know any more than what one else would know based on his information that's public, other than the fact that he was in the U.S. Army and severely wounded in 1969 in a firefight, and then was able to survive that, even though he was paralyzed from the chest down, for an additional, 6 years. and then he passed away in 1975 from those combat injuries that he suffered in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And was it because of that, the death that came a bit later on, that it was not initially on the Iowa Vietnam War Monument, his name?
Well, you know, as we have said in various times, that can cause an issue. You know, they had those kind of issues on the Vietnam War Memorial in D.C. But he was on that monument, which was constructed in 1982. So somewhere in the process of the data and databases, when you deal with that many names, you're going to make errors. It's just something that's going to happen. And the wall in D.C., they would say the same thing. There are errors. We accidentally leave folks off. But once uncovered, then we have a responsibility to put that name on the wall and be recognized.
Mm-hmm. People may be more familiar with the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., the long, sloping black memorial there with all of the names of the fallen in Vietnam there. Describe for us the Iowa Vietnam War Monument.
Well, the Iowa Vietnam War Monument, as far as I know, it's made from the same black granite. This one, ours doesn't appear as shiny, but it is. I don't know if it's quite as black, but it's made to have some familiarity to the wall in D.C. We have five panels, and ours are all above ground instead of underground, and the five panels contain the 867 names that are Iowa veterans that died due to injuries in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the work that you and others had to go through to add Douglas Peterson to the Iowa Vietnam War Monument. Was it a big task?
Yes, it was, and one would not think so. I guess it started about 2 years ago, and serving on the commission, involved with various legislative activities, and somewhere along the line I had heard that there was a name that wasn't on that. And through some investigations, a name did come up, and then I started checking with the Vietnam Wall in D.C., and the name was on the wall in D.C., so that completely changes everything. Well, if it's there, why isn't it on our wall?
Exactly.
So then we do the investigation, and then it went from there.
Mm-hmm. A long process, and people are grateful that you did it. Dan Gannon, why was it so important to you?
Well, I think it's important to me because I care about veterans. I everything I do for veterans is purely volunteer, and I want to make sure they're all being given the credit due. A motto of the Vietnam Veterans of America is we do not want to leave a veteran behind, and I thought it was time to put closure on this. If this person belonged on our wall, and bring our brother home after 40 years.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can do this, maybe difficult. How are our Vietnam veterans doing as a group? Is that something you can even characterize?
Oh, I think, yes, I do. And I think that question needs to be asked more. And we need to have, I think, more honest answers. And because I don't think we always get that. As you know, usually when we talk about Vietnam veterans, we can be very easily stereotyped.
Mm-hmm.
That we're struggling with issues, we have long hair, we're on drugs and alcohol, and we just can't cope with life. And the biggest thing that people need to know, that is not a true example of the Vietnam veteran. That would be a very, very small percent, but they seem to be in the media more than the rest of us, because most of us have gone on, had successful lives, very successful lives as Vietnam veterans. We coped with our problems. We dealt with them. We moved on with our life. And there is thousands of Vietnam veterans in our communities that you wouldn't even know they're there until you start checking around and you find out, wow, I didn't know this person was a Vietnam veteran or this person was a Vietnam veteran. For example, Colonel Bob Myers, who's the CEO of Casey's, I didn't know he was a Vietnam veteran. Once I found out, who's had a successful career after you got out of the service, you start talking with these folks, and you find out these other folks, and those folks need to be heard from based on their experiences from Vietnam.
A conversation I had earlier this year with Dan Gannon, the Vietnam Veterans of America representative to the Iowa Commission of Veterans Affairs. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. In Ames, we had help from Sean McLean. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.